Well, believe me, Mr. Kinney, that is the least of your imperfections. And if I'd wanted to leave you, I've had better reasons, plenty of them. Now, why don't you get your ass back in bed, you son of a bitch, and eat some fucking chicken soup.
From Slightly Unbalanced, we are still queer as folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Today we're talking about episode 9 of season 4, and it's called Have Some Balls.
It first aired in the U.S. on June 13th, 2004. It was written by Sean Postoff and showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman. This is Postoff's fourth of 7 episodes, and he never wrote for television again after Queer as Folk. He is now just a working artist in Toronto.
Have Some Balls was directed by Kevin Inch, his 7th of 8 episodes. Notably, he directed the season 2 disaster called The Wedding.
Oof.
We won't hold that one against him, though. That was a script fail.
Here's the synopsis of Have Some Balls. Brian begins... I want to say, like, ball and then in parentheses, S. Yes. Brian begins radiation treatment after having a testicle removed. Ben meets a fan of his first book who has curious intentions.
Curious, all right. Debbie starts plotting a way to get back into Horvath's life, and Lindsay ramps up her gallery opening of Scoundrel Sam Auerbach's work.
And Emmett caters an engagement party for a professional football player and is later de-pantsed by the hunky new arrival, quarterback Drew Boyd.
I wrote this one myself again.
Really?
This was pretty much what I'm going to call a chicken soup, take out the trash episode.
Have some fucking chicken soup.
That's right. There were a lot of storylines going on, but not a lot of depth to any of them. We had Brian's ball, Ben and Michael fighting, Justin and Michael fighting, Sam stalking Lindsay, Emmett replacing Vic, Emmett being raped by a football player, and Debbie finding out that Carl is single. So that's 7 storylines going into a single episode.
I look forward to when we talk about the moment between Emmett and Drew and whether or not you would really describe that as rape. But yes.
I picked up on a theme of this too. So as we're talking about this episode, keep in mind that rapey theme, I guess.
It's terrifying that that's the theme. Yes. Okay.
So a story, Brian's ball. I don't know if this was really so much an A story as it had, I think, the most screen time.
It was sort of just the first story that we had.
Yeah. The first of 7.
Isn't this fun? Maybe for you, but that's because you are a sadistic shit!
Who, me?
I'll never tell you where the jewels are.
Make that jewel. Now lie still. Who knows? If you're lucky, you might even get a few more good years. Like me.
I thought the intro was funny, but I think it's lazy storytelling to use Vic as the archetype for death, aging, cancer treatment, things like that. This is the second one in a row now. So it's like, rest in peace, Vic, right?
Yeah, no, there's this continuation of using Vic as a haunting tactic for Brian. And this time, of course, it's as this like mad scientist in a bad sci-fi B-movie fantasy that you'd probably see on like Mystery Science Theater 3000.
I did like those little, I guess we'll call them panties, that Brian had on, those little silver reflective panties as the laser beam pointed at his crotch.
Because he's getting, radiation.
Exactly. Something that occurred to me when watching this episode was a missed opportunity in the last episode. So remember when Brian came out of surgery and there was that hunky nurse that was waking him up?
That I was sure he was going to fuck, yes.
Wouldn't a great way to stitch the Brian-Justin conflict of the last episode together be to have had Justin be the recovery nurse when Brian wakes up from surgery? Even if it was just like his voice overdubbed on top of the surgeon. It just seems like if Justin was woven into that story very early on, it would have had a little more dramatic teeth later on when Brian flips out and throws him out.
Yes, because, and I think we'll get into it more as we continue on, but the big issue I had with particularly Brian's storyline, is the way he treats Justin throughout the episode, especially from the end of the last episode and throughout this one. It doesn't track to me.
Yeah, there's just something missing from it. And I just started to try to like find ways to increase the Justin story so that it was a little more meaningful. Back to Brian's balls.
Ball.
That's right, ball. Since Brian is getting radiation after having his other ball removed, his cancer is much more advanced than we thought last episode. That seems like a detail that we should have been told about, because last episode, it seemed like after surgery, that would be it. Now the story seems to be extending itself. There just seemed to be a continuity weirdness going on here.
Yes, I agree. I thought the whole point of him having the testicle removed was because that's where the cancer was. They thought it hadn't spread. If they remove that now, he should be fine. But instead, he's also still going through radiation treatment.
Yeah, so this clearly wasn't like a stage one, like early detection thing. This had gone on for a while, which also, again, leads me to believe that it's impossible that Brian or one of his tricks and or Justin would not have noticed something on his ball long ago.
Unless he doesn't like his balls played with, which I would be surprised.
Who are those people?
I'm not familiar.
So Brian bans Justin from Connecticut. Connecticut? Kinetic.
He is banned from the Northeast. Right.
Cynthia!
Jesus, Brian, what's going on?
You can't just kick me out.
Watch me. I don't want his calls. I don't want him in this office. And if he comes near me, I want a restraining order. And if some asshole named Vic Grossi calls from hell, you can tell him I'm in a meeting.
Does it seem strange to you that Brian, the owner of this business, would act so hysterically in front of his employees and bring his personal life into the office like that?
Well, and look at Cynthia's reaction. She's like, but this is Justin, and you're telling me that he is no longer allowed on premises and that you would get a restrainer? Like, she's looking at it weird, going, what are you talking about? That's Justin.
And apparently, you know? Cynthia can get restraining orders on Brian's behalf, too?
Yes, because she is assistant.
Right. I also think that if anybody in the office was acting like that, they would pretty much have an appointment with HR that day. I mean, you can't yell and scream and like berate people in the office that way. At least not anymore, right?
Where do you think HR is located in his bathhouse office?
That's a good point. So the notion of Brian being this angry with Justin continues to feel fake and contrived to me. The idea of the story is good, but the writers are hitting us over the head with it over and over and over. And this is one of those less is more moments that I think Queer as Folk really needs.
100% agree. And it's only exacerbated when Ted checks in on Brian and is like thinking he's on drugs or something.
Oh, yeah.
He said, and Brian just gives it up and says, no, it's the big C. And instead we get cocaine, crystal, caffeine. It's like, no, cancer, you idiot. So we've just had this huge explosive moment where Brian is threatening Justin with a restraining order for revealing that he knows about the cancer diagnosis. And here, Brian is just like, oh, yeah, Ted, I have cancer.
Right.
Where's the drama now? Like, then it does not make any more sense why Brian would be so vicious towards Justin. It does not make any sense to me anymore. What really just like really got under my skin was Justin is letting Michael have it in that he knows that he was the one that told Brian that they knew about the cancer. And Michael just says, I didn't mean to, like a 12-year-old. And I was like, thank God Justin called out how much of a BS excuse that was. He's like, and that's where I'm like, thank you, Justin, for being the one who saw right through that and is saying like, no, that's lame. How dare you? But I was also super distracted during this fight by those pants. And I'm really glad that we have moved on from baggy boot cut.
Justin's pants?
And Michael's. Michael's were just as awful. Like, thank God we've gotten into a more fitted world.
I just think like Justin Timberlake pants. Oof. From that era. Bit of trivia here. We finally learned the name of Michael's comic shop. It's called Red Cape Comics. Up until now, we had never heard the name of his comic shop.
His comic shop.
Yeah, he bought it from Buzzy. And so I think it used to be called Buzzy's Comics.
Maybe it's just a branding opportunity because of Rage.
There's something also interesting about Michael's behavior in this whole episode is that he never once discusses his issue with Brian with anybody but Justin. Ben has no idea that this is going on.
Debbie has no idea this is going on.
Like, yes, that comes up later.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking that if Michael was like this upset over Brian and this wrecked over it, why didn't that get drawn into the Ben and Michael story, that little saga of jealousy? Why couldn't he have raised this issue with Brian fighting for his life to Ben and then have Ben once again freak out over Michael spending thought cycles on Brian instead of his boyfriend's novel?
It's as if
this story was like in a bottle.
It's as if there's only so much recycled material they can put into one episode. So like, you know what? We're going to have to cut this. We're going to have to show some restraint here.
At this point, he had not yet been vicious to Michael either. So Ted gets easy, tells a really bad joke, and Justin gets dumped.
But it feels very weakly placed.
Yeah,
I don't.
Definitely.
I don't see that.
I felt like Brian 2.0. Or are we on Brian 3.0 now?
2.5.
Brian 2.5 would have aged out of that notion by now. He would have gotten to the point of where he is more gracefully aging because he's not 29 as he was when we first met him. But there's been endless stories about...
30.
Yeah, oh, he's like 31 or 32 at this point. There were plenty of stories early on about this very subject. And yet it comes back to be walloped on us. It's just like another tired, recycled story. It's like, enough already.
Yeah, I feel like we're getting to the point in this series where everything feels very template.
Mm-hmm.
We know Michael's going to be mad at Ben, or Justin is going to do something that reads like a betrayal to Brian. So check one, check two, check three. Yeah. And then we'll move on to the next story. And then the same notion will happen.
I also thought it was like completely nonsensical when Brian yells out that line about Vic. It's like, if you see Vic Grassi, tell him to meet me in hell or whatever. I was happy to, I was happy that Vic's in the show, but both Justin and Cynthia know who Vic is. The only thing so that line did.
Why are you talking about Vic?
It just makes Brian look unhinged, which maybe that was
exactly
the point, but it just seemed like nonsense. And plus, nobody really reacted to it. They're just like, all right.
Yeah, Justin just left.
Yeah. And Cynthia's like, okay.
Cynthia's just like, yeah,
next.
What do I do?
So an offshoot of Brian's story here was Ted and Dandy Lube. I just wanted to talk about this real quick, even though it kind of didn't matter in the overall storyline. Just how many times can Brian have an ad pitch with the older executive decision maker and either a son or a younger hot guy there to say, gee whiz, dad, the gay market is where it's at, and then go to the bathroom?
What he means is that with a sexier, more playful new image, you can expand Dandy Lube's share of the market.
By suggesting we have half-naked muscle boys offering lube jobs in a clothing optional garage.
By appealing to women and gay men.
It's an interesting point that gays are an important demographic these days.
This is the fourth.
So first I want to point out Scott Lowell's physical comedy during this meeting, because he's trying to emanate Brian.
We've seen this before, by the way, too. Remember when he borrowed the loft?
Yes, exactly. So here, like, he throws the apple, but like instead of catching it and being sexy, he just drops it, and he's completely fumbling and a total putz.
The difference between our lube and their lube is our lube says sex. If you want to be cool, if you want to be popular, if you want to get laid, this is the lube you use.
And then it's up to Cynthia to save the pitch. And as this hot son walks away from the meeting and gives a glance to Ted, and Cynthia's like, go get the account. And I'm like, I felt like as soon as I saw the client's son that Ted was going to try and fuck him. Yeah. And my assumption was that this was going to be like Because we had like all the setup of this wasn't working, like the meeting wasn't going Ted's way, that he was going to try this and this was going to blow way out of proportion and be even more embarrassing. So like I was cringing waiting for this moment to happen. I was shocked that it worked.
I almost think it would have been funnier if it didn't work, right?
Yes, that would have been amazing if it hadn't worked. But then I also felt really proud for Ted because of all the shit he's been through that he actually got some. Good for him.
This particular story of woo the client in the toilet has happened, as I said, 4 times now in Queer as Folk, and it also happened 3 times in the UK series.
Wow.
So it's like, guys, come on, think of something new.
But at least now he's in a bathhouse where it only makes sense to fuck in the stall.
Yep. Well, I have a note about that as well. Okay, so they're in the bathroom, which is an interesting urinal. It looked like a certain bar in Chicago with a basement that really just has like a drain in the floor that you relieve yourself into. But anyway.
Yes. It was like a step up.
You're looking at me like, which bar is it? Oh, I know which one that is.
Yeah, I think it's the one that's down the street from me.
Yes. Are you a regular? Is that your local?
No, it is not.
So Ted comes into the aforementioned room, and he all but assaults Doug DiCarlo, that's the character's name, by just dragging him into the stall, and then mysteriously the scene cuts. Why didn't we get hot softcore porn in the toilet like we used to? We didn't even see the stall door close.
Yes, we did.
Well, we didn't see the
door close.
We didn't see the little
The little latch.
Yeah, that goes to like the occupied.
Occupied?
Occupado.
No, like we know that there is clear cruising happening because Doug looks over in Ted's direction, kind of looks him up and down and saying, is there anything else you'd like to show me?
Yeah, I don't know. I when I watched it again, I thought that Ted took a little bit of a liberty by just like grabbing this guy and dragging him away. It's like, you asked first.
And this is where I thought it was going to go all wrong.
Oh yeah.
And instead it's like, no, it works.
Yeah, that would have been better story. Like he goes to drag him away and then slips on the wet floor or something. Does a pratfall.
Something. Oh my gosh. That would have been great.
So Michael shows up at Brian's loft and is pounding more and more aggressively on the door over and over and over. 2 things here. He didn't know that Brian was home, and what caused him to increase his pounding level? Because, you know, he starts out with just a very simple knock, 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 and then it's like knock, 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 yell, pound, 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 yell, yell, scream.
Brian, Brian, Brian. Oh, my God.
So then Brian tries to kick him out, but why did he answer the door in the first place if he was going to kick him out? Why didn't he just lay in bed and think, he'll go away?
The fact that he...
Why did he go to the door?
The fact that when he does open the door, he chides Brian for saying, like, you should be in bed. He's like, well, there was someone banging on the goddamn door. I'm like, Michael, think for once. Literally give me 1 second of you thinking. No. I did like when he went to his fridge that he saw all he had was beer and poppers.
That's fair.
What then it made me think is that, am I supposed to be saving my poppers in the fridge? Is that where they're supposed to go?
Yes, absolutely. Keep them cold.
I keep them by my bedside. So I
actually, now that you mention it, they always have played an important role of being in the refrigerator, because when Brian brings a teenager home from Babylon, he goes to the refrigerator, gets a bottle of water, pours it over himself, and then grabs a popper and then takes a little
little sniffy sniff
off of it. So now Michael mysteriously gets the Justin treatment from Brian and Ted is off scot-free. But I'm just having a hard time keeping track of exactly who Brian is pissed off at and when.
Yeah, I still don't understand why Ted does get off scot-free. Brian gives up that information so willingly to him. There was no battle to it whatsoever. And still, Ted's just like, yeah, so I know. What's up?
This whole Brian's ball storyline, it's just so weakly written that it's annoying me. And it seems like a story idea that they could have done a lot with. And I mean, they did do a lot with it, but it seems like they could have done better.
It's so clumsily handled. That's the issue with it. Because I mentioned it as it being one of my tops from last week, is that I love the fact that they're giving Brian this track of vulnerability, and he's opening himself up to emotions, period. So, yeah, it's a shame.
But they're just directed at one person.
Yes.
Instead of, like, across the board. Well, I guess he loops in Michael into that rage eventually, but rage. Oh, I get it. Rage. See what I did there?
That's why he's rage.
So as this episode's wrapping up, I think the final scene of the episode is Justin showing up at the loft. Well, actually, Justin is at the loft.
Yeah, he's just there.
Yeah, oh, this reminded me of something, too, is that they all have keys to one another's apartments. We've identified that earlier because we know that Brian and Michael exchange keys for just such an emergency. So I don't know why Michael was pounding on the door so hard. He could just open the goddamn thing, right?
Right.
And then Justin has a key. So he comes over and he's cooking in the kitchen. That reminded me of that episode when he's cooking jambalaya with the hot Southern boy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, my boyfriend and I, we make jambalaya all the time. We just cook and fuck.
Now, you can either stand around here eating jambalaya, you can come upstairs and eat my ass.
Yes.
So Justin's there. He's cooking, which is always great to see Justin in the kitchen. And I thought it was great that Justin finally stood up for what is right in their relationship and just let him have it. But did he have to really throw Brian to the floor?
You're not getting rid of me. Shit, are you all right? Tell me you're
all right. I'm all right.
You're not all right.
Then what the hell are you asking me for? So that I can tell you what a motherfucking piece of shit you are for not telling me. For shutting me out. For thinking that you could handle this on your own. And most of all, for thinking that I would leave you. Why would you think that? Because you had a ball removed? Because you're no longer perfect? Well, believe me, Mr. Kinney, that is the least of your imperfections. And if I'd wanted to leave you, I've had better reasons, plenty of them. Now, why don't you get your ass back in bed, you son of a bitch, and eat some fucking chicken soup.
So like everything else in Queer as Folk, everything's resolved. Justin is safely ensconced back in the loft, and Brian's life, roll the credits.
Exactly, and he's making him some fucking chicken soup.
It was that easy.
This has been the problem with this whole season, is that everything seems to wrap up just so easily. They don't let the drama really ruminate for, like, say, the whole season. Like, this whole storyline could have carried us the entire season, but it doesn't.
Oh, yeah. Brian gets over cancer in, what, 3 episodes?
Yeah. Who cares if he has one
it's
ball?
It's a miracle.
The end. You're like, well, you give us such a great cliffhanger, and great. Now where do we go with it?
Still Queer as Folk. Stick around. We got a lot more to talk about tonight. So our B story of the night is Ben, the sight of Michael, some dude named Anthony, Hunter, and Rage.
Just again, mishmash. Mishmash of all sorts of stuff.
This story gets set up at breakfast. Did you see that Hunter poured chocolate milk into his Captain Crunch?
I was less questioning that than the size of the bowl he was using.
He did pour the whole box into that bowl.
It was just so...
I mean, those sugary cereal, I could eat a whole box of Captain Crunch. All that sugar in there,
It was just so obnoxiously large as he's just shaking this entire box of cereal. And I'm like, I'm sorry, as his guardians, you would think they would have wanted him to have like a well-balanced meal. But then again, I'm pretty sure that's because even Michael said, like, can you please save some of that cereal for me?
Well, Michael has eaten sugary cereal like from the beginning of the show.
Yes, and like, but clawing at the spoon the way he does.
Yeah, it's like Hunter weighs like what, 125 pounds? He can afford some sugary cereal, yes. Right? Mm-hmm. So apparently Ben is still so fragile about this that they decide that they just can't use the word Hollywood in his presence.
Ben is going through a tough time right now. I'm sure all this talk isn't making it any easier. So, from now on, let's try not to use the word Hollywood in a sentence.
Ben the professor is that fragile over it.
It's so exasperating because I want to continue to like Ben, but he cannot use the fact that Michael is having success in his career as a reason to hold something against him, to hold a grudge against him. That's not Michael's Agreed. Fault. You know?
That's right.
And the fact that Ben even makes like a little snide comment, because you know, Hunter is looking in like a guidebook of California and all the things they're going to do when they go to Hollywood. And Ben is still trying to make sure he's like, well, are you sure it's going to happen? It's like he sent a contract to option. So, yes, this is happening.
Well, and plus, like, you can go to California without having that option.
Right. Right? What vacation. What's wrong with a vacation?
So there's a new character named Anthony, and right away I pegged this kid as a sycophant, just sucking up to Ben. We sense that he has some kind of agenda with Ben, but we don't quite know what yet.
Yes, we know that he is a former student and that he is a writer as well. He loved Ben's book.
Like it spoke like to him.
Loved. And it just shows how easy Ben falls for flattery.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting this serious Alex Forrest vibe from Anthony, and I don't trust it.
I thought that that Anthony showed up at just the right point for Ben, though, and I thought that this was going to be a throwaway character because all Ben needed was somebody to say, hey, like your shit, whereas this kid's got some staying power, and he's a Ben fanboy, and Ben really just needed to hear that his work was reaching at least one person in the world.
And that's what I was kind of hoping that that's all this was, all the storyline will be, which is, oh, my work has some worth because it reached this person. Maybe I'll ease up on Michael.
Yes. Roll the credits.
All I need. Wrap it all up. I need. He just needs that to be opened up. I don't need this guy going out and getting coffee with him and then like continuing to show up because I swear to God, he's going to boil a rabbit next. I kid you not.
Do you know what happens with this character? Do you remember?
No.
This story gets interesting in a couple episodes. So there's some discussion that they're having as they are having lunch in what looks like a high school cafeteria that I bumped on.
The part where all your friends were turning positive?
How about over there?
Fine. But you still hadn't been infected.
Yeah, I remember feeling terrified that I'd be next, but at the same time, feeling like I just wanted to get it over with.
I don't think that Ben is quite old enough to have been sexually active when it was unclear how HIV was transmitted. So how are all of his friends becoming positive? Are they just being careless?
Hmm. That's a very good point.
Back when AIDS didn't even have a name, it was called GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency. And then there was AIDS, and then it was discovered that HIV causes AIDS. That was like the 80s, right? So yeah. Mm-hmm. Ben's line about all of his friends becoming positive and he just wanted to get it over with seemed weird to me. He's not that old. He's not of that generation where it was the great unknown and nobody really knew what was going on.
Right, because that existed more in the 70s, I would presume. Like 70s into 80s, where it was like
80s. Yeah,
where it was like, we don't know what this is. It's continuing to just be called the gay disease because they felt it was only affecting gay men. And I feel like he was really coming up, because Ben is not that much older to where like...
No, he's like 30, right?
Well, no, I think he's a little older than that. I think I felt like he was...
30, 35
maybe, but because he's still able to have that fling with Brian.
Right.
So, but yeah, I don't...
Maybe Brian likes older men.
Yet he's with a teenager at the beginning of the series. I don't know.
Well, he's a professor and he has TAs. So I think that would put him around 30 to 35-ish.
Okay.
But this was just kind of a weird thing for Ben to be saying. We've commented on this in the past about how often the characters say things that are out of character for them, that they don't quite plug into what that character really is.
Yes.
It's like we have a narrative that we want to tell, and we are going to make use of whatever available character we have.
And so for this one, we're just going to go ahead and use Ben.
This particular storyline would have played better with Vic, because this was a Vic's era, not Absolutely. A Ben's era. So to help Ben get over this, though, Michael buys him a computer.
I would love to know what you thought of this gesture. Because I...
Okay.
Because I don't think that it makes up for the rejection that Ben receives about his novel. However, I felt like it was a sweet gesture from Michael to say, but I know that this one didn't work out, but please continue your writing. Please.
Yeah.
Like, I thought he was being encouraging, and Ben yep. was offended. Like, it felt like he was offended by it.
Yeah. Great gesture, bad delivery, and bad timing on Michael's part. This should have been like a discussion, not like a surprise gift. It should have been, yeah, I got some money. It's like, you are my partner in this, and I couldn't have written Rage without you. I want to support you in your career. Now that I have some money, I would like to buy your computer because you're writing your book longhand.
What's so bad about that?
Instead, it's like, ta-da, here's a computer.
Yes.
And at one point, I was like, Jesus, Ben, accept the damn thing.
It's seriously. Just accept like, it and move on.
Yeah, don't turn this into this like relic that is always going to be around. Like every time you see the computer, you're going to be like,
rrr. Also, who writes novels longhand?
A lot of authors do, actually. Truman Capote wrote almost all of his books.
Okay, longhand. Truman Capote.
Granted, this was in the 50s and 60s.
Exactly. I'm sorry, but
we didn't type them.
We are in a world where word exists.
Yeah, I write my journal longhand mostly because I just feel like it has staying power. Like it's the written notebooks are going to be around longer than some file lost on a computer someplace.
But if you were to transcribe said journal, you'd use a computer.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
This is what I'm getting at.
Recopy
like,
it. Yeah.
Like I totally understand. Like maybe he's notating. Maybe he's writing out outline. Sure. You're going to write the damn yeah. thing on a computer.
So Ben decides to give up writing. All because Michael is finding success in his own work. And
I have nothing now.
I thought it was such a dick move to tell Michael to return the computer. It's like, oh, it's like you are such an ingrateful boyfriend.
Such a child. And that's
yeah, from the one of the most mature characters that we have in the show.
I don't
one of
understand.
The most evolved and highly developed. We've talked about that before, about how Ben started out as this like, God, this guy's kind of cool. Like the Buddhist, the living in the now, dancing until you drop and making the most of your life, even though you've been dealt a shitty hand. And nope, he's like all over the board now.
And so petty and
he goes on steroids.
Yes, and rages on that and then like recovers. And now he can't stand the fact that he can't get published anymore. It's like, well, maybe because your writing is substandard. And the fact that someone like Michael tried to give you notes on it from someone who could possibly be a consumer and you just dismissed it because he's you think he's an uneducated Philistine. Like, what?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. That came up too. Previous episodes. Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. Okay, story number, what is it, 6 or 7 here?
31.2, yes. 5.
Debbie. So there's a nice, reasonable headstone for Vic, finally.
It was tasteful, but respectable. I loved it.
I did too, but the whole scene was a mess. So first of all, there are two extras in the background of this scene as Debbie is kneeling in the snow, wiping the snow off of Vic's headstone, having a conversation with Vic. There's just these like two dudes wandering around at a different grave.
Yes. They're probably cruising the way Michael was way back when.
Well, second, the interplay between Emmett's phone call with who knows who he's talking to.
It was
to.
The whatever chef that he was supposed to have for the party.
Yeah, who's that?
Some rando. Because remember, Vic was the chef. So now he's just working with a bunch of people he can hire.
And that I hope that you forgive me for what I did.
What did you do? D-U-I? Well, who's going to help me cater the party tonight?
And all because of a silly party.
No, I will not recommend an attorney unless you recommend a chef.
Rest in peace, little brother.
Rotten hell, you little fucker.
Debbie's having a moment, and there's like people in the background. There's like Emmett having in the background. Once again, in this episode, though, we're being hit over the head with stuff that we already know. We know Vic died. Let Debbie have her moment. We know that Emmett doesn't have a chef. It's not hard to find a new one. Don't talk over Debbie.
But also,
thank you.
I agree with all of that. I just kind of thought, like, we got so much going on. But I also do need to give major kudos to our costuming again, because Emmett is giving Dr. Zhivago realness. I loved everything he was wearing in this scene, that I almost want to forgive the fact that he's having a completely different storyline that's overshadowing this tender moment, because he looked great.
He did. And this is setting up Emmett for many more episodes. But this was Debbie's moment of closure with Vic. And there was so much piled on and sprinkled around her that we never got that moment. We never really got that time of her just making things right with Vic. Remember the Herald, the archangel from last episode?
Yes, Herald, who just walked in and then walked away, never to be heard of again.
So Debbie wants to get back with Horvath. So she starts reading detective novels, of course.
The October Detective?
It's one in a series.
Of 12?
How did you guess?
Well, it comes to clues. I'm quick. For instance, I've never known you to read detective novels.
So?
So I would surmise, using my brilliant powers of deduction, that it has something to do with one Lieutenant Horvath.
Sorry, Sherlock. Carl came here strictly as a friend, and there's nothing between us.
You know, the look in his eyes said otherwise.
What do you know about the look in a man's... Never mind, I take it back.
Stop living in a book and start living your life.
The note that I wrote was, this was super weak writing, and at best, it's kind of a teenage move. And then as I was typing this out, I was like, come to think of it, I think I'm positive that I did something similar. And so I thought about it for a while, and I knew this guy that I liked, and he was super into the show Riverdale. So I started to binge on Riverdale so that we would have something to talk about with each other. Is that what Debbie was doing here? She's like reading detective novels so that she can like talk police shit to Horvath. Hey, how was it at the office today?
Oh, that's interesting, because I took it more of, I'm still not pursuing what could be in my reality, so I'm still going to just live in my fantasy. Like there's a detective right there that she had previous interest with, but because she doesn't want to pursue it in reality, I'm just going to live it in fantasy, which is what Emmett was trying to get apart. He's like, okay, you're reading a book, but the real detective is literally right there, so why don't you go and talk to him?
And I'll remind you that she gave Horvath the best blowjob of his life.
Hey, I would say she learned from the best.
Well, maybe she wants more. Maybe she wants to get on that D again.
The Horvath D? Okay.
The Horvath D. So to further that, she just shows up at the precinct.
Oh.
And she, I did like that Horvath said that he was devouring his manwich.
Just about to devour my manwich.
In my neighborhood, that's three guys fucking.
You might also know a manwich is a sloppy joe.
Yes.
I don't know if that was like Midwestern speak or.
That's what it felt like. Cause like, that's how I've known manwich, at least growing up.
Yeah. Manwich is a brand name though, isn't it?
Yes.
Can't you buy like manwich in a can?
Basically, yeah. Yeah, that's what it is. It's sort of a pre-made sloppy joe.
I'm a vegetarian.
Well, good for you.
No manwich for me. So she comes in to see Horvath, and she brings up the idea of getting a bite to eat. But then all of a sudden Horvath has seen somebody. But just last episode, he made this really, really sweet and touching visit to Debbie's house, knocked on her door and asked her out for a bite to eat. The writers convinced us then that he was there to rekindle things with Debbie. And now, an episode later, it's like, oops, not really. It was just his friends. So I felt like really betrayed and misled by the last episode.
Yes, it was a shame. Because, you know, I want something good to happen for Debbie. Why is that so bad?
Have you ever done a Debbie like this before where you like get it all wrong about somebody, and then you find out that they're like actually like really seriously involved with somebody else.
Huh. Not that they're involved in someone else, but that there's definitely been moments where, oh, wait a minute, you were actually interested in me? Oh, shit. I could have done something about it then.
That's a man-witch.
Oh, well.
Let me devour your man-witch.
It's fine. I'm very happy now. I'll take that.
So this little runner ties itself up, and we find out that Horvath is dating somebody named Catherine. Story number 6. Emmett and Drew Boyd. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, like,
You're leaning forward in the microphone, pulling up your notes. You're like, I'm ready. I'm going to do it.
Well, so in conjunction with what is going on with Debbie, we have Emmett scrambling to find a new chef because apparently his previous chef for this engagement party for a football player named Drew Boyd has gotten arrested for a DUI. So at first we get reintroduced to Chandelier, who's ready to make her return, which is super exciting. And
I had a question about Chandelier.
Oh, yes.
Darren, why is Darren constantly sending Debbie food?
Didn't she help in his recovery after his bashing?
I thought that was Justin.
But Justin was living with Debbie at that time, though. I think maybe because she's a staple of the neighborhood. Maybe that's what it is.
By the way, this is Chandelier's last episode. Never hear from her again.
Well, that's a shame.
Yet she's Emmett's partner in the chefing, but he's gone.
What a shame, because they were talking about how wonderful their food is. I would love to have kept them around.
You know, it took 3 scenes and Debbie withholding food from Emmett to get to Darren. It felt more like filler, though, because sure, it could be an issue for Emmett to keep his business going without Vic, but the solution payoff was so easy that there was zero obstruction getting there other than Chandelier's broken heel.
Yes.
Couldn't you have just like called him or something?
The easiest fix I think we've seen in this entire series. Break a leg. It's not going to work. I broke my heel. I need money. Okay, great. That happened literally in 20 seconds. Not even 20 seconds. 5 seconds.
Do drag queens rehearse that way? Like, do they go to the bar where they're going to perform and like rehearse?
I mean, I would say there's a sound check. I wouldn't necessarily say there's a full on rehearsal like that.
Not like in the Birdcage?
No. Fosse. Martha Graham. Madonna.
Twyla.
Oh, but you keep it all on the inside.
So Drew insults Chandelier, Darren, and Emmett.
Hey, Drew, where'd you get those caterers?
Looks like a couple flamers to me.
Cut up the flat. What are you going to do?
Excuse me, Mr. Boyd. You next, I hope I'm not out of place for saying this. Actually, don't give a fuck if I am. Back in Hazelhurst, Mississippi, where I grew up, I was always taught that if a real man has something to say about someone, he says it to his face, not behind his back. So even though you may be a star, you know, captain of the team, hero to millions, you still have a lot to learn about being a man.
I respected that. I like that. But that's kind of unprofessional to do, like, in front of everybody who's your client.
Well, I will say he did basically make Drew excuse himself, and they had more of a private conversation. He didn't like lambast him so that everybody at the party heard, but he did have a one-on-one, you know, sort of publicly, but not everyone would have picked up on what was being said.
That's fair. He didn't like grab the microphone or anything.
There was no like, check, I have something to say. No.
He stops by Drew's house later, and of course, Sierra is off with their girlfriends, seeing some chick flick. Couldn't this line have been done better to, you know, kind of empower Sierra as a strong, independent woman instead of being a trophy wife? She's off with the girls with the chick flick.
That would ask of the writers to create some subtlety. And I don't think they were necessarily up to that task. I think they needed to set Drew up as a stereotype of kind of a dumb jock, because when he, you know, lets Emmett into the place, he said, how about a beer? He's watching the game. He's, you know,
that's how porn starts. I love that.
Yes. Also part of my notes is that That entire scene is like a porn. That entire seduction is like a porn scene. And Emmett was a porn star previously. So I like the fact that I don't know if he was picking up on like, yeah, this is how a lot of porn starts.
The dialogue and acting in the scene was great. There was this sexual tension that just kind of kept building and building. But I think the writers missed out on a chance to make the scene more dangerous for Emmett.
There, I will say there was a brief moment. I would say it was less the writers and more on Peter Page for creating that tension, because he had there was a hesitancy of coming into the house.
Right. Because the last thing we heard was Drew Boyd like being homophobic towards him.
Oh, so I liked that there was that beat, and it was an acting beat that clearly Peter Page probably put in of, okay, I'd be home alone with this guy who clearly has an attitude towards someone like me. Do I really want to be here alone?
Yeah, I wish it was just more, though. I wish that Peter didn't have to just inject himself into it. I wish the writers would have really turned this into something, as if Emmett was afraid of being bashed, not just awkward around somebody that he recently told off. It just seemed like a missed opportunity to increase the intensity of what's about to happen.
Wow.
It's like if he answered the door like holding a baseball bat or something.
A football player holding a baseball bat?
They're sportsmen, right?
Okay.
Okay, how about a barbecue tongs?
Yes, he's grilling. He's grilling out back. So Drew hands him that check. He hands him a beer. I do need to talk about the moment where he's like, the beer's fine. And he just lifts up his shirt to reveal all of the rippling muscles. And I'm like, wait a minute. And even Emmett has this sort of like, hold on. Is this baiting? Like, what's happening? And I tell you though, when Drew tackles Emmett, I was screaming at how...
You like that?
How erotic that was, because he takes him down somewhat roughly onto the carpet, and the way he tells him like, touch my bicep, you're like, oh my god. I'm literally getting hot thinking about it.
The Sierra line was hilarious.
What about Sierra? She thinks I have a nice body too.
I did have some problems with this scene though. This is the third time in this episode where a character physically grabs somebody without obvious consent. So we had Ted and the client, we have Drew and Emmett, and in a second we're going to talk about Lindsay and Sam.
Okay.
And wouldn't this have been more dramatic to have Emmett turn him down and fight him off and make him work for it instead of just offering up his ass? I mean, this was like another moment that we were talking about earlier where the payoffs are so quick and easy and everything just happens spontaneously. I just think that this could have been stretched out a little where the pro football player is trying to dive into Emmett's butt and Emmett's like not having anything of it. And then over a couple episodes, he warms up to the idea. And then the roles reverse where Emmett is the one that is having to pursue Drew. Too much? But you keep it all inside.
The second Drew flipped him over and literally in one fell swoop got his pants off. Clearly Emmett wasn't wearing underwear
or a belt
or anything, because he got those pants off.
Or suspenders.
Easy. I was just like, yeah, okay, let's make this happen.
I had a question about that though. Do you think, because Emmett starts to like moan and groan and go, "Arr." Do you think he was being topped or rimmed? What do you think Drew Boyd went for there? Is he an ass man?
I mean, clearly.
Or is he just like, well, I mean, does he just want to stick his dick in something, or does he really appreciate a man's ass?
I feel like yes is the only answer to that statement.
Well, how would Drew really know what to do anyway? Does he have experience?
Yes, I would. 100%, I would say he has experience, because he knew how to seduce Emmett real quick.
He didn't seduce him. He like threw him to the ground and attacked him.
No, he started off as playful. And then when he got him down to the ground, Emmett could have, well, it's possible that Emmett would have been too intimidated by someone like Drew to say, no, get off me or something like that. But it felt also like there was this moment of, yeah, I am on top of you. How are you feeling about it?
What? I didn't see that moment.
I'm giving myself a lot of unspoken moments between these two in order to make this work in my head. So yeah. Anyway, it was hot.
I would like to think that Drew went in to rim him.
Possibly. Yes.
I like to think that.
Because I mean, clearly lube was not readily available there on the carpet. So I'm sure he had to do something to get Emmett ready.
So story number 7 of the night, Lindsay and Sam with a side of Michael and Melanie. Michael goes to Lamaze class with Melanie. This scene totally did not need to be in the episode. It did not add anything. Cutting it would have given more time for the more important stories, like Emmett getting rimmed by a football player.
Much more interesting. Like I had honestly forgotten that Michael was the donor for Melanie. I had actually forgotten.
I forgot that Melanie was pregnant.
The only reason why I remember that was because in the last episode, she was eating a lot. And that was it.
She takes
like Ted's food that he left or something like that. That was the only, I was like, oh, right. She's pregnant. Yeah, she's pregnant. So she's eating for two. Sure. That's it.
That was a little bit of subtlety that I missed. I'm like not accustomed to looking for it.
Yeah.
So at the gallery, Lindsay and Sam, tell me if I'm reading this story right. Is Lindsay attracted to Sam physically?
No, I don't think she's attracted to him.
Is this a sapiosexual moment with Lindsay? And what was that hug all about? I don't know what to think of this story. I know how it ends, but I don't.
The only note I have about this whole storyline is I don't get it.
Me either.
Why? Just why? Because I think I would say it only feeds into a stereotype that lesbians are easily seduced by men and that they still, at the core of themselves, still want some sort of phallic option inside them. And I think that's bullshit. So that gets to the core of why I have such a problem with this particular storyline in the series.
There's a comment on our Facebook page from a listener that talks about how Lindsay being bisexual is given short shrift. I'm not so sure that she is bisexual, though. I just don't know where she's coming from with this particular thing with Sam, because I've been attracted to people that I admire in a field that I aspire to work in. And I would probably like do what Lindsay's doing, but I don't think that makes me straight by any stretch of the imagination, agreed. Or mm-hmm. even bisexual.
Yeah.
It's just a different, totally different level. Sapio. It's unclear where this is coming from with Lindsay. But I will say that the writers do try to explain this away in a couple more episodes.
Yeah, and I'm still going to call bullshit on it.
We'll just have to wait,
yes. So, shall we move on to our tops and bottoms?
Tops and bottoms. What's your first
Drew
top?
Boyd.
How many tops do you have?
Drew Boyd.
Drew Boyd is your
Drew
top.
Boyd is a clear, total top. Drew Boyd. I love that he gets introduced in this. His dumb jockiness kind of like really works for me. And I want to be tackled by him any day of the week. So my top is the top, is a top, is any top, is all tops, Drew Boyd.
Debbie is my top.
She's a top two, yes.
Debbie having that moment with Horvath, I thought was really cool. She's there to pick up where she left off, but Horvath has moved on. That's a good story beat. It's two people being into each other, but out of sync, and they're kind of wiggling around until this kind of natural alignment or realignment happens. And I thought that was probably one of the most compelling stories in this train wreck of an episode.
For someone who is treated as such a bombastic character, it was nice to see that the softer side of Debbie in this episode. So I like that.
Did you notice that I picked the straight story?
For that once. Was my top?
I know.
Usually you're so tired of it. You're like, I don't know why it's here.
Yeah. Oh, it gets worse as as the last season and a half goes on. So what was your bottom? Who was your bottom?
My bottom is Brian continuing to punish Justin so much. It really begins to ring false in this episode, given how easily he's able to let Ted know what he has experienced in terms of having cancer. And I think he still goes easy on Michael and continues to want to just hound at Justin. And I don't understand it.
That's kind of close to my bottom. My bottom was the sheer amount of cruft in this episode. It just made it an endless runner with only one resolution, and that was Brian and Justin. This episode could have been much, much tighter. That's kind of why I called it the chicken soup, take out the trash episode. It's like you make chicken soup out of all the leftovers that you have. You know, you've eaten the whole bird, and then you take the carcass and you drop it into a pot and you keep making soup. That's what this felt like. It felt like a whole bunch of loose ends and a whole bunch of like garbage storylines that were just thrown together to have an episode. In episodic TV, these are often called bottle episodes, where you can just drop this episode in the event of, like, say, writer's strike or something like that, where you can produce the episode because you've got all this material available already. So in that sense, it felt like an awful lot of these stories were just kind of like cut from earlier episodes and cobbled together into one episode. Mm-hmm. So that was my big complaint with this episode. This has been episode 9 of season 4. Have some balls. Next time on Still Queer as Folk, we cover episode 10, where Brian has a confrontation with his mother. Joni Kinney's back. Ben's fanboy reveals his real goal. And we see what happens with Sam and Lindsay. That episode is called The Snake in Paradise.
Fresh reviews and ratings on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to us are much appreciated, so please take a moment and help us out. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
You can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall if you'd like to connect with me directly.
And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me tonight. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with a fresh episode. Still Queer as Folk was made with love.